And can I invite you, if you can lay your hands on a copy of the Bible, to open it at 1 Corinthians chapter 15, around page 1156. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the Bibles are underneath the seats in front of you. If you can't find one, then find someone who's been here before and they might be able to help you to get a hold of one. 1 Corinthians is on page, as I say, 1156. We're looking at chapter 15, and the clue that you're at the right place is that it says at the top of the passage, the resurrection of Christ. Paul says there to his brothers and sisters that I want to remind you of the gospel I preached to you, you received, and in which you have taken your stand. By this gospel you are saved if you hold firmly to the word I preach to you. Otherwise you have believed in vain. And then we come to the words with which I started our service this morning. Actually, they've given you time to find the page. 1156, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And then it says, Paul says, at what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures. And after that, he goes on to say that Jesus appeared to Cephas, or to Peter, and then he appeared to the 12. And after that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, some of whom are, or most of whom are still living, although some have fallen asleep. And then he went on and he appeared to James, that is Jesus' brother, and to all the apostles, that is those who have been sent with the good news. And last of all, he appeared to me, Paul, as to one abnormally born. And these words have been used many times by folk as part of the proof of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead as a historical event. And you may well have been through that evidence before. First of all, Christ really was crucified. Crucifixion was so brutally done and professionally done by the Romans that there was no chance of anybody accidentally surviving it. The stone that was rolled over the tomb, massive as it was, and the Roman guards who were posted there would have made it impossible for anyone, even if they'd wanted to get in to steal the body. And those who were most likely to have thought of that were the disciples who we know were overcome with fear and had run away or were in hiding. And yet in spite of that, on the Sunday morning, the tomb was empty. An earthquake had shaken the stone out of its place, and there was nobody there either then or afterwards. So if the Roman authorities, or indeed the Jewish authorities for some reason, had taken Jesus' body away to keep it secure, then as rumours of resurrection began to circulate, they would simply have reproduced it and said, you're wrong, but they couldn't. And of course, the change in the disciples, those who had been too scared even to stand by the cross of a dead man, suddenly were found boldly proclaiming in marketplaces and in front of authorities, and even at the risk to their lives, and in some cases at the cost of their lives, affirmed that they believed that Jesus was dead. And all these facts taken together provide forensic proof of the resurrection. Lord Darling, who was once a Chief Justice in England, Lord Chief Justice, once wrote, "We are not merely asked to have faith, because in favour of the resurrection as a living truth, there exists such overwhelming evidence, positive and negative, factual and circumstantial, that no intelligent jury in the world can fail to bring in a verdict that the resurrection story is true." And then to that evidence, we can point, as Paul does, to these 500 eyewitnesses, most of whom, he said at the time, are still living, which was an invitation to his Corinthian readers to go and ask them for themselves. Go and speak to someone who saw him if you're not sure whether he rose again. And let them tell you one after another, hundreds of times over, that Jesus really has risen from the dead. But actually, that's not the point that Paul's making here. In these opening lines of chapter 15 that we've just read, he is simply making as the starting point of his argument, making sure of something that everybody actually already believed, that Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. There might be people today who doubt that. In fact, we know that there are. And Paul's words about 500 eyewitnesses may help them by accident to reconsider their position. But the gospel that Paul had preached to them in Corinth, and which they believed and were taking their stand upon, took Christ's resurrection for granted. And there is no suggestion anywhere in the letter that any of the people he was writing to had even a moment's doubt about that. So what then is the dispute about? Why is Paul writing about the resurrection of Jesus from the dead in such an argumentative way if nobody disagreed with him? Well, we get to the actual dispute if you look down the page to verse 12, where it says, "If it is preached that Christ has been raised from the dead, how can some of you say there is no resurrection of the dead?" In other words, the position of some of those he was writing to was this: yes, Christ was raised from the dead because he was exceptional. He was God the Son. But he was the only one. There is no such thing as resurrection from the dead for the rest of us, even for Christian believers. And on the face of it, that doesn't seem a particularly daft argument, does it? Because most of us have seen, as they would have seen around about the city where they lived in, graveyards and cemeteries or crematoria where dead people stayed dead. But actually, their objection was not just based on attending lots of funerals that had no happy endings. It was also based on their understanding of life and death and spirituality. They didn't want resurrection. They didn't want to stay alive or to live forever. What they wanted to do was to get rid of their bodies as soon as possible. They saw their bodies as the problem. And what they wanted to do was to rise above earthly things to some kind of spiritual, ethereal, heavenly splendor, a purer existence that was uncorrupted by earthly things, because for them, their bodies were the problem. There were lots of things you couldn't do because you had a human body. It held you back and it tied you down. And there were lots of things you wanted to do because you had a human body. It was bodily desires which were dirty and corrupting and shameful. So as far as they were concerned, the sole purpose and point of Jesus' resurrection from the dead was to prove the difference between him and us. He was a super spiritual being. His resurrection proves it. And therefore, we should follow his spiritual teaching. It was almost as if it was a scientific experiment. You know, if I had a piece of paper in one hand and a piece of metal in the other hand, and I held them both to a candle flame, then of course the paper would burn away to nothing, and the piece of metal would be unaffected. And to their minds, the resurrection was a bit like that. Other people died and stayed dead, whereas Jesus died and came back to life, therefore he was different. He was superhuman. He was of a different sort, a different kind of material, an alien from another world of spiritual superiority. And our desire is to become like him and to be changed according to his nature. And Paul's reply is to flatly contradict that. That's what the argument is about. It is preached that Christ has been raised from the dead, but how can that be? if there is no resurrection from the dead. Because in verse 13, if there is no resurrection from the dead of human beings in general, then not even Christ has been raised. Because in fact, he was a human being just like us, with the same kind of body that we have. And if the rule is no resurrection, it applies to him as well as us. And therefore, our preaching is useless, because what we've been telling you is a lie, and your faith is in vain, because what you believe isn't true. But in actual fact, if you look on to verse 20, it says, Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, not as an exception to the rule, but as the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. You see the point here? Paul is not arguing. Could I have another battery? Paul is not arguing about the resurrection and the importance of it for Jesus or what it proved about him. Arguing about the importance of the resurrection and what it means for us, what will happen to us because it happened first for Jesus. Resurrection is the future of believing humanity. Christ is the first fruits and Christians are the rest of the harvest. Christ is the worked example or the prototype and Christians are the production line. So we will indeed become more like Jesus, but not by leaving our humanity behind with its temptation-prone body and painfully twisted psychology, but by becoming fully human like him, the image of God in us restored. So this resurrection of Jesus 2,000 years ago means two things for us today. It means, first of all, that the end of time is now. We do still need our graveyards and cemeteries and crematoria because the bodies we have are finished with when this life is done. Dust returns to dust and ashes to ashes. But at the end of time, we receive the new bodies which are described here in verses 42 to 44. Our old bodies are the fruit, are the seed, and our new bodies are the fruit. Now, the physics and the biology of that are beyond us, but that's fine because it's not our problem. We don't need to make it happen. God does that. But the point is that the physical bodies we have now will be ours again in some new enhanced way, immortal, clothed with immortality. And that doesn't happen until the end of time. And the point is that it's already happened to Jesus, because the end of time has begun to happen now. That God is already doing it. He's not saying, look, I want you to believe in some incredible vague future possibility that sounds like pie in the sky or the happy ever after of a fairy tale dream. I want you to observe a historical event. I want you to look back to when the end of time happened in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. So that when you ask the question, when will the end come? The answer is it's already started. The first resurrection has already taken place, and the evidence for it is strong. And so we're living right on the cusp, right on the edge of that end breaking in finally and for all of us. And it's already a part of our human experience. And second, that death has already been defeated. Look at how carefully Paul chooses the words that are up there on the screen. He doesn't say in verse 4, as some other parts of the Bible do say, that Jesus rose on the third day. The way that I rose up out of bed this morning, I got myself up. He says Jesus was raised on the third day, like a parent who gets their child up out of bed in this morning. So you see, we don't have in Jesus an indestructible Son of God who could not die or whom death could not hold on to. Rather, we have a dead human being, as dead as the rest of us will someday be, raised to life by a death-defeating God. And therefore, to share in his resurrection, we don't need to be perfect like Jesus was, or super spiritual like Jesus was, or divine or superhuman like Jesus was, in order to rise to everlasting life. We simply need to have the same Father that Jesus has, to do for us what he did for him. And we know that death is all the distance that exists between us and God. It is eventually what puts us in our graves. But before that, death is a process that hardens our hearts and makes us less sensitive, less loving, less caring than we should be. It dulls our senses, which makes us less open to God and less aware of his presence. We don't see him and we don't hear him. It fences our pride, which makes us think how great we are and how clever we've been and not realize how shamefully we're wasting away. It entombs our generosity. It makes us cling and keep for ourselves, cling to what could be given away and shared with others. And it condemns us all to conflict and to misery. Death, in verse 21 of this chapter, is what came through a man. And Paul is thinking of the story of Adam in the Garden of Eden. But since life through resurrection has already begun, it is that other man in that other garden, the tomb in which he was laid, who has brought death to life, or left death in the grave. Jesus was raised on the third day, according to the scriptures, bringing him back to life and taking him home to God, and that's good for him, and he does live there happily ever after. But on that day, resurrection also entered history, bringing us to God's conclusion. No more waiting, because God is already here. And no more mourning, because life has already begun. And now that curse of sin has no hold on me, whom the Son sets free, is free indeed.